I'm honored to have my next guest on. His name's Daryl Smith. He was a part of the Fayetteville Police Department for 18 years and is still affiliated with the SWAT teams. I'm truly honored to have him on. He's got an incredible story, some tragic in his story that we're going to dive into. Without further ado, I really appreciate you coming on. I know it's going to be hard to talk about. I can only imagine, but I really appreciate you coming on and share your story, brother.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So I kind of want to dig into like your background, where you grew up, the path you led to get to where you mm-hmm. ended up in the police department and, you know, how it led you to do what you're doing now. So,
Okay.
Did you grow up in the Fayetteville area?
No, I actually grew up in New York. It's a place called Westchester County. That's probably one of the wealthiest counties I know in the state of New York and across the country. And a small town just up north, about 30 miles north of the Bronx, Caucatona. It's just up from White Plains, New York, for those who are familiar with the lower New York area. And grew up there and all the way up through high school. Then I left for college. And that's when I ended up in North Carolina, going to college in Salisbury, North Carolina, small college, Livingstone College. And it's kind of funny because where I grew up, I was the only black kid in my class. And so had great friends and godparents to my children. And then when I went to college, I went to a predominantly black college. It was like a culture shock. And I was like, okay, I gotta get used to my own culture. It was kind of funny because I was like, whoa, it was like a shock to my system. And so I went there. My parents, my father, he drove Greyhound, and he actually drove back in the Joe Namath days. He drove for the Jets and the Harlem Globetrotters back then. And my mother, she was in the Department of Corrections, where she, you know, was a regular correction officer, sergeant. Then she retired after 30 years as a lieutenant in one of maximum security, women's security or prisons there in the state. And that's where I've led me towards my law enforcement background, where actually it was my mother who taught me how to shoot when I was 16, because she was a firearms instructor. She was on their SRT. You know, she's a troop. And I really looked up to my mom and what she did. You know, her nickname, she had her and her partner, her nickname was Starsky and her partner was Hutch. And because she took no stuff from anybody. Even to this day, she's 91 years old, and I still have somewhat of a fear of that woman. She lives right about 4 miles from me. And but she looks like she's in her 60s and she's still going strong. I call her the original Medea, you know, the OG, because she does not take any mess at all from anybody. Carries a snub nose 38. And so that's where I learned my shooting from. She of course outshot my father, and so I looked to my mother. When we moved to Fayetteville, she took me out to the ranges out there in Spring Lake. And I always had this passion of, even in elementary school, passion of being a police officer. Didn't really think I was going to do it because my father, he was seeing me as a, you know, a doctor. But I had this passion in my heart to be a police officer. And we had that old school TV show SWAT come on. And so that's what I wanted to do ever since sixth grade. And so after college, I graduated with a math degree, did nothing with it, but graduated with a math degree. And, but my heart was where I wanted to go, and that was in law enforcement. So it was between actually the State Bureau of Investigation, SBI, and Fayetteville. And Fayetteville actually was faster, or it happened first, which I am grateful to have worked there and still be affiliated with the agency. That was when I started off. I started off as a patrol officer, and I only did that actually for 8 months. And after I got released from my field training, and then I did 3.5 years as a canine officer, and that was a great time. Just fell in love with my dog. He's protected me. It was called Vietnam for a reason,
Yeah, I'm sure.
especially back then. And he saved my life a couple of times, and he always got a T-bone steak when he got home for doing that, and his name was Flash. And then after that, I really had the passion for SWAT, and so since then, since 1992, from then on, it was nothing but SWAT. So I became a member. We were full time here in Fayetteville, which very few teams were. Probably Charlotte was, and Raleigh. And then became a police specialist or a corporal in comparison to the military, and then a sergeant and team leader, and did all of the different units. We had the assault element, and we had a sniper element, and then I brought on board the explosive breaching. And I believe our team, I haven't heard anything different, our team was the first team police agency to do explosive breaching back in a live explosive breaching back in 1995. And so they built on that foundation, and I'm proud of the guys on the team today. They're awesome operators, and just so glad to be affiliated with them and to help the young guys out. And back then we were super busy, and hundreds of calls per year. And I'm glad it wasn't, you would think, being Fort Bragg, I'm glad it wasn't those calls, with soldiers. We did have an uptick on that after, during the war, or after the war, guys will come back and from deployment.
Let me backtrack just a second. For the people that wouldn't know much about law enforcement, what's explosive breaching if they didn't know
Right.
what that was? Kind
Okay.
of explain it a little bit.
Yeah, explosive breaching. It is, you're using an entry tool or entry method. You have mechanical tools like a battering ram to use, but explosive breaching is used mainly to get through a door or wall if you have to in certain circumstances, but a door without fragmentation. And that's one of the things that I had to explain and demo for the chief, because the first thing when I heard explosives, they're thinking about shrapnel and all that. So I had a videotape, with a 3D mannequin behind the door, and did a charge where it gets the team in there much faster, without any problem, especially if the bad guys or suspects barricade the door, which happened on the first one we did. They saw us. They had a steel door with a steel pipe behind it, when it and the charge just blew that off. So it also protects the officer, the team members, to get in there quick. They're not standing in front of the door, trying to hit that ramp. Just imagine someone trying to use a battering ram against that kind of door. They're not getting in for a while, and it just leaves them exposed. So that was the main purpose that for explosive breaching, is to get the operators or the teams into an objective real quick, without fragmentations. You may have wood splinters if anybody's standing behind the door, But they're given, an opportunity, because we announced that there's a warrant being served. So usually when they hear that, they're not going to stand there behind the door. So it gives them that opportunity to get away from the door. And we haven't had not one person over the years injured from using explosive breaching.
That's amazing. So now, what is the qualifications to go from like a regular cop to a SWAT officer?
Well, today you have to, it's a PT test, of course, that they have to run. Usually it's about a 2 mile run or a mile and a half run. Some obstacles they have to go through. And with our team, you'll have to do the PT test twice in the beginning and then do obstacles and then at the end. And you'd have to score high, usually above a 90. And if you can't do that, then you're deleted, you're canceled out. They have to go through a board and see if you're psychologically fit and ready and to be prepared to do the things that you will have to do as a SWAT officer, because not everybody can do that. Or even wants to do that, looking at being shot at more often than the regular patrol officer. So you have to have that certain mentality. And we have a lot of guys, who served in the military who are on the team. So with that added experience, it really helps out. It really, brings up the quality of the team. And they have about 26 members on the team. And that's not including, crisis negotiators, but yeah. So the guys are pretty busy, and so that's what happens. We have guys who fail. And of course, they just don't meet the cut. Whether the PT test or whether firearms. And we tell them, keep practicing and try later, and some do, some. Some just give up right away because they don't think they can do it.
Well, I'm sure it's strenuous, and that getting shot at every day ain't cool either.
No, it's not a. It's all fun and games till you have the lead coming your way, right?
That's for sure. Yeah, had a little bit in Iraq myself, but yeah, I thank God I came home. Now, you're still involved with them actively, correct?
I am still involved with them. The chief had brought me on, and it did a couple of things for me because ever since I retired, and let me go back to the reason why I retired. I retired because I got run over by a drunk driver. I was working up by the Cross Creek Mall, actually, up there, and as a team, then we were working all over the city. We worked, it was almost like a wolf pack. And not only did we did the training, but we did a lot of violent street crimes. And that particular day, I was ready to get off and go home. And there was an off young officer who there was a traffic accident on. It's called the All American
Highway.
Expressway. Yep,
Yep.
and Morganton Road, right there in the mall area, that bridge. And so I said, what the heck? I'll go ahead and help him out. And so I went out there and directing traffic is at night. I had my reflective vest on, flashlight, and the cars with the blue lights were gone. And they had fire medics come out there, but they went back. And about 10 minutes after they went back and was directing traffic, this one car, he obviously wasn't paying attention to me and I couldn't see him. So I'm waving my flashlight to move over because I was standing behind one car involved in the accident. And there was another car off to the left in another lane. So I needed him to go around this car that I was kind of blocking. And he was looking at the other patrol vehicle and officers and the people and wasn't paying attention to me. And so when I realized that he didn't see me, he was going about 35 miles an hour, when I realized he didn't see me, I yelled, and by that time, it was too late. I realized that it was like things slowed down. I just said, "Well, I'm not going to see my kids anymore." And then the last thing I said in my mind, I said, "This is going to hurt." And next thing I know, got hit by the bumper, hit the hood, and then the smash into the windshield. And I woke up under the guardrail, which saved me from going over onto the
Yeah.
expressway. Yeah. So I had, of course, a knee injury from that, and back injury from that as well, which was my second surgery. My first one was when I was in K9. Got bit by, we were doing bite work with the K9. And the melon was, they hit you at the same speed that they're running. And when he hit me, his name was Max, a 90-pound Malinois. And he hit you like a truck, and he spun me around, and I landed wrong and blew out a disc in my neck. So that was my first surgery. And then with this one, that basically the doctor said, "Well, you can go on, but if you're doing squat, then you're gonna end up possibly paralyzed." And I couldn't see that, all my three children were small at the time. And I said, "Well, I hated to leave." And well, you know what? Let me back up. I got to give you a
Sure.
backdrop of that of I think why that happened. I was raised, growing up, I was raised in the church. Of course, my parents took me as a kid going to a Baptist church up there in New York, and doesn't mean that I had given my life to Christ. I just went to church, and so I grew up and went to church here in North Carolina, in Clinton, North Carolina. And my pastor, I was working the sound system because I played the piano, and but he wanted me. I was working the sound system, and then he just saw the light, God's call on my life to be a minister. And I'm like, no, I'm no, I want to do what I'm doing. I'm happy with SWAT and everything. I'm not leaving the department to go into the ministry. And he kept, long story short, he kept pushing me and saying, "Come, God's calling you." I'm like, "He's calling you, maybe, but he hasn't said anything to me."
Yeah, for
And
sure.
so one night I said, I just got mad with God, which was a mistake. I looked up, I said, "God, if you want me off of this department, you're going to have to take me off because I'm not getting off." That next night is when I got hit by that car. And
Wow.
so I said,
Wow.
maybe it's a coincidence, I don't know, but I was like, okay, I won't do that again. Check. And so yeah, so I did end up being in the ministry. I pastored for my wife and I pastored for 14 years. We raised three beautiful children, two boys and a girl. My wife and I, we met in high school, rival high schools up there. She went to Fox Lane, I went to John Jay, and we were rivals. And 2 years older than her. We've been together 41 years now, married 36 years.
Congratulations.
Thanks, 36 years. And two of the kids are married, so I'm a grandparent of four. The fifth one's coming in December with my daughter, and it'll be her fourth. And so yeah, so I when I got hit, going back to that, had my surgeries, and it took me about a year to recover from that surgery. And that was around the time, after I was good to go, around the time that the war started, or it was just 9/11 happened. And because our team, we had at that time, our chief had a good relationship with commanders and generals out there at Fort Bragg, especially in the SOF community. We did a lot of training out there, and so that was awesome in itself, and a great learning tool to happen. And actually, I think was part of it was because it training out there was probably what saved my life in a shooting incident that happened when we did a hit on a motel room across from the
Oh, wow.
VA. What happened was that a week before that, we were training all week long, CQB out there at Bragg, out there in the soft community. And that shooting incident, it was like training, and it almost seemed like the same sims simunitions that was going on. To me, that's what it sounded like. Go ahead.
CQB is close quarters combat for the
Yes,
people
I'm
who
sorry.
don't know. No, you're
Yep,
fine. You're
yep.
fine.
Yep.
I
And
do it too, but I had to
yeah.
catch myself sometimes. Just want to, just so people that don't know, they're
Yeah.
like, what's that acronym? It's
Right,
close
right.
quarters combat for all the civilians out there.
I apologize.
No, you're fine, brother.
And so what happened was we had a legitimate warrant to go in that house. It was actually what they called a no-knock warrant, where you didn't have to announce yourself to before you enter. Normally, you have to say police search warrant, and then you breach the door. And we used the battering ram. This one, because of the information we got from the confidential informant, and who was undercover and undercover narcotics officer, he said the guy usually, and it's sad that it happened, but he was a Vietnam vet. But he's usually sitting up in the bed with a 38 in the bed with him. And so it's a small motel room. So when we got up there, it was a good thing that when just as we breached the door, as the breacher was ramming, we did yell police search warrant right at the same time, simultaneously. So we did announce anyway. And it was a good thing that he breached it the first time, because it probably been a different story if it took him two or more times. We probably would have taken rounds through the door. And there was two or three steps just outside this motel room. And so once he breached, I was the second person in the room. The first guy, good buddy of mine's, Blair, he did what we were trained to do. And so he hit that corner to the left. And as soon as the door was breached and he hit the corner to the left, that's when the first round went off. And it just sounded to me, because of the adrenaline, you have, auditory exclusion, where the sound is much less. And everything slowed down. It was like slow motion. As soon as that first round, I actually saw him, and I can recall it to this day, that when I saw him when he got hit, and thank God he was wearing a helmet, and he flinched, but he kept moving. Some guys would have froze up at the door, but he kept doing. I mean, he was a big guy too, kept moving, and so that opened a way for me to get in as a second person. And he flinched, and just as he flinched, I came to, and the guy turned on me, and the shots. We were probably about 7 feet apart from where the shooter was. And I recommend to the young guys out there, operators, that wear eye pro,
Yeah.
because we were close enough to get the I just went blank. The powder, wow, it'll
I
come
know what
back
you're
at me
saying
real
too,
quick.
and I can't think either. The muzzle,
Not just the muzzle. I don't know why I just went blank on it. Anyway, gunpowder, into your eyes, into your face. That's how close we were.
Damn.
Another, the FBI measured it another half an inch lower, it would have hit him in the eyeball. And so, shots of fire. It was all about maybe 6, 7 seconds from the first shot to the last shot. For us who were inside that room, was just me and him at the time, it sounded like ammunition rounds. To the guys outside, they were like, "What in the world was going on?" You know, it was loud, but we hardly heard anything. And
Wow.
so I remember every segment of that first time of taking a life here in the States, which, you know, probably helped me going overseas. And we were justified in it. Of course, the media tried to crucify us and everything.
Oh yeah, they always do.
And you know, the chief, he backed us 150%. And but you know, it still bothered me a little bit. But even though I said, "Hey, better he than me," and I'm going home to my kids and to my family. So, but it still plays through your mind how close it could have been for you, and how it would have affected the family, you know, family and everything. So, yeah. So we were, you know, nowadays it's like 3, 6 months talking to officers now before after they have a shooting, you know, they have to wait and be on admin for about 3, 6 months, depending on the agency, before they can go back to work. We were back at work the following week, and we were
Wow.
back knocking down doors the following week, you know, and that's just the way it was back then. And so yeah, so anyway, I kind of forgot where we left off. I know we, you know, after getting hit, I challenged God and retired, recovered. And after recovering, I got called to, after 9/11, that's when they started kicking up the federal air marshal program. And because I've worked with the guys out there for Bragg, I got recommended to and called to work with a cadre of I don't know how many of us, but mostly we're from the soft community, and we've had guys from group to ride along with us, so they saw our, you know, our capabilities and everything. And so of course they did a lot of training for us, so it was basically the same format. And so did the air marshal program, and
How was that?
it was good. It was good. You had, in the beginning, you had quality people, but you know, they wanted the quality, and then it turned into the
Quantity.
quantity. That's all they cared for. And I tell you, some people who had went through the air marshal program, I said, "I'll, you know what? I'll just take the gun from you on the plane and do, because this is no joke." The firearms portion, I was part of the first the pistol and then the aircraft tactics team. And so you get people, we were at the last week. And so you get people coming to the firearms portion the last week. Literally, some of them, it was their first time handling a firearm. And this is when it was all about quantity. I mean, we had some good people in the beginning who just came out of the either military and so forth, or you know, federal law enforcement agencies. But then you had people who just never handled a firearm. This is how bad it was. We were going to do some PT in the gym, and there was a room that people can get their equipment. And so you had a student there, I'll never forget this. He asked for a red gun, or you know, a plastic or rubber gun to practice, you know, your grip, sight alignment, sight picture, and you know, being safe. It's plastic, it's rubber. So the guy handed him the box with the rubber gun. He opens up the box, no joke, and looks in it and says, "Do I need to clear it here?" Okay, and so that's from the quantity of what the government wanted to put out. So I don't know what kind of training they're getting now, but it is scary. And so we did that, and then one day, myself and one of the other guys who were on the team, we were told to meet up in a motel room. Gave us a room number and went in there. We're like, okay, what's going on? And he sat us down, and this is when the war had just started. I think it was March of 03, and they wanted us to, and we sat us down, and they were putting a 30-man team together, a task force together. And most of those guys came from, the unit and soft community, a couple of SEALs. And but three of us got recruited from Fayetteville, from the team, to be a part of this. They wanted a couple of law enforcement guys, and they saw, they vetted us. We've been out there to train a lot. So when we get up there, they tell us what's going on and if we wanted to be a part of it. So we were like, okay. My partner and I, we were like, we better call the real boss at home and see if they're going to go for this. And so they told us how much we were going to make. And when I told my wife that, she said, "When are you leaving?" So
Oh, man.
I'm like, okay, I guess that's a yes, guys, And and I thank God for her. At the time, she always supported me. She knew I was happy doing those types of things, and I'm grateful for that even to this day. She says, "As long as you're happy, I'm happy." And going back to being the advisor and a mentor for the team, ever since when I retired, all the chiefs that have been there always supported me and wanted me to stay affiliated with the team and to help the guys out. And I said, "Sure." And then because that gave me life. And then, then there was one particular chief who left not too long ago. She took me off of took me away from the team. She didn't really care for retired officers, and that just crushed me. And that was real hard, because I was going through, and I know we'll talk about it more because of with my son, and that, and I felt really purposeless then at that time, and so being a mentor still to this day has given me that life. But going back to the task force, we went over to Iraq. Actually started off in Kuwait in April,
We're in
and
Kuwait.
right there,
We're Kuwait,
Kuwait
though.
City.
Okay.
I can't remember that nice resort
I
right there
can't.
in
I didn't know
Kuwait.
if y'all went to Ali Al Salim or Camp Arif John, Camp
No,
Doha at the
no,
time.
no. We stayed off of that.
No, I'm sure.
Because we were actually, I can say it now. We were working for the agency, so we stayed away from that. So April, we were going in, into Iraq, and I tell you what, just the knowledge base of working with those caliber guys. I mean, a lot of the guys that I've worked with were the same guys who were in Somalia,
Is it one guy we know?
well, no, No,
Okay.
it wasn't. He wasn't there at that time.
Gotcha.
But the guys that he worked with, and so it was a lot of OJT, a lot of things that, saved my life. Used my cat lives up probably about three times. When I say three times, that's three cat lives, not just three
Yeah.
times, because spent 5 years off and on there. And so we were
Oh, wow.
all over the place. We didn't live in camps. We lived a lot of times we lived in the city, and so got a
Dangerous.
lot. And saw a lot, did a lot. But you know what? Actually, working with Fayetteville and working in the city where I saw a lot, it was like, it was a good thing. It wasn't new to me, It was
Yeah.
just the getting shot more, getting shot at more was a little bit different. But it wasn't new to me. So
Were you ever in Tikrit?
we went down there for a run for an operation, but we didn't stay there. Yeah,
Yeah.
we were mainly in Basra, Baghdad, and Erbil and Mosul. So. But we stayed a lot in and then we had three sites there in Basra, Baghdad, and Erbil, three different teams. And so I spent a lot of time in Baghdad and in the villas where all the other special operations from different units were. And yeah, it was good times. It was good times. I'd go back and do it again, but
Yeah, them guys are elite of the elite of the elite, so.
absolutely, absolutely. So God rest their souls, two of my team leaders have since passed away, and both of them, they were in Somalia, and one of them was in the helicopter that went down. And he awesome man, awesome. And so
You're talking
yeah,
about Operation Red Wing?
no, this was in Somalia. When the
Oh, okay,
yeah
gotcha.
when the bird first helicopter went down. His first name is Jim. I'm not gonna say his last name out of respect, but
Understand.
he was an awesome leader. I learned a lot. One of the things you do is just shut up and listen, and learn from those guys. And it paid out in the long run because I learned a lot over the years, and still, I'm still working with my boss, who was a command sergeant major out there. I still do contracts with them when they need, when need be. So I'm living the retired life, but. When it's time to go, it's time to go. Yep.
No, that's awesome, man. Pretty crazy career, to say the least. You know what I mean? A lot of people don't even get know what that kind of stuff's going on, that you would get picked to be in that kind of group. So that's, man, that's amazing.
Rare occasion, rare opportunity, is something that President Bush wanted at the time, and we had to give him our team leaders had to give him updates, on a daily basis. So yeah, it was a very rare you won't hear that in law enforcement
No,
too much of that happening.
that's really cool. I wanted to say something when you said you lived in Salisbury, right? I used to live in Salisbury. Yeah. Mount Ula area.
Oh, really?
So I lived in Mooresville. I lived in Salisbury for a little while. Yeah. But moving forward, I got a couple questions. Well, one topic we want to talk about is PTSD. And have you been affected by it, which I'm sure you have? You've been shot at. It doesn't leave you. You'll always remember it, and it affects people differently. So I wondered how you handle it, and what kind of steps you've taken to deal with it.
Right. Well, yeah, I really, and as far as the law enforcement side of it, all those years, I wasn't really, it didn't really bother me. I didn't know if it had PTSD. It was until after I came, after years in Iraq and coming back, we had lived in Tampa, Florida, for a while. And finally, when I first, my after my first time coming back from Iraq, we my first tour, I was over there 8 months, which is pretty, you know.
Long time.
Yeah. And so when I came back, man, I, you know, you don't know that you're messed up until you come back to the normal, you know, because I was messed up when I came home. I was hearing mortar rounds going off at night. It was one time where I threw my wife out of the bed because I heard mortars going off. And there was another time because of that, I swung and punched her in my sleep. And so I spent some time on the couch after that. No more sleeping in the bedroom for a while, you
Yeah, for
know,
sure.
because I would, you know, I would, you know, I don't believe in putting a hand on a woman. I don't call you a man if you do that. And it just happened. And then she wouldn't let me drive because over there we took over the road, you know, and drove how we wanted, when we wanted. And when I came home, I was driving like I was over there. And I was running red lights. I remember we had, it was one time, I scared her to death, but it was one time, I guess they were having problems with racers on Rayford Road. And there's a hill and it dips down and comes up, and then you have that Walmart. Well, you had racers, what they do, you have two cars that would block the traffic coming in, coming downhill, so that two other cars can go up the hill and race. And so as soon as they did that, I just we just happened to be driving, and you know, it was just like I just flipped, and the switch came on because I was thinking ambush. And you know, we were driving hard vehicles, and hard vehicles is armored vehicles. And I just floored it, and I just hit it right at them. And my wife screams like, what are you doing? And I scared the guys in the car because they moved out the way because they thought I was going to hit them. And but I just went back to, you know, the things that happened over there. And so I was just doing some wild things. And you know, my temper was like this. You know, I couldn't go out, she, out to eat because you just hear some silly crap that people would say, and you know, who probably never left out of town and didn't know what they were talking about, and it was just ticked me off. So the temper was real short. Had trouble, you know, reoccurring dreams, nightmares, and so it was really rough that first time. So I was more affected after coming back from Iraq, but I didn't really, maybe I didn't acknowledge it, but it wasn't until my wife finally convinced me to talk to someone. You know, I didn't think I needed to talk to, I don't want to talk to anybody, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem, you know, that's for the weak-minded, and later for that, you know. And but finally, you know, I said, well, maybe I should, you know. If, and I just happened to get a therapist who worked with guys in special operations, and she was fantastic, and down there in Tampa. And she would talk to me, and she I asked her, I said, do I have PTSD? And I don't like to call it PTSD. I like to call it PTS, but disorder is just, I don't know.
Makes you
But
sound like you got a deficiency, and it's not.
And so she goes, oh yeah, 100% you do. And because it was you know, I really had trouble with, you know, holidays like the New Year and the 4th of July. And I had problems. I my son had, my youngest son he had to keep me from lock me, basically lock me in the house and take away my shotgun because the people next door were shooting off fireworks that sounded like mortar rounds. I guess those M80 type rounds, whatever. And I was like, oh yeah, you want to see fireworks? So I was going out to the back with my Remington 1187, and I don't know what I would have done, but it wouldn't have been good. And so he had to take it away from me and kind of calm me down. And so those days really bothered me for a real long time. And the biggest thing that I'm dealing with even to this day is sleep. You know, everything else I'm cool with. It's just with sleeping. I mean, I'm gonna be honest with you, that 2 nights ago people were shooting off fireworks like crazy, and I don't know why. I didn't think it would affect me, but it affected me in my sleep, and I was just having, nightmares, and to the point where I didn't even want to go to sleep. So I spent, stayed up all night. But what I did was, I was like, I can't live like this. And a man who I considered my mentor and a big brother, who was, out there with the unit. You're talking about a legend out there. His first name is Greg, and he, his wife is a psychotherapist, and he recommended me, and I recommend this to anybody. It's called EMDR. EMDR. I tell you, look that up. If you can find anybody in your area who is certified in that, and it's eye movement desensitization, sensitization, if I said it right, and reprocessing. And I basically call it resetting, and it resets. It's a process that helps reset your mind, and it's like a rapid eye movement. You're taking your finger and you're following with your eyes, and all the medical stuff I don't understand, but it took a they it take a story that really bothered you. Let's say you had a real tragic incident for the guys who served overseas, something that happened. They'll take that story and want you to kind of talk about it and kind of relive it. So it's not easy at first, and then you use your eyes. They'll do it for about a minute or two, and they'll just see how, how do you feel after that. And it takes a few sessions. You go once a week, and after a while I found that, oh, that is, it doesn't bother me as much as it used to.
Wow.
And then the other one that really helped me was called P is PE, prolong, I think it's, yeah, immersion, PE or PI, prolong immersion. Now that one, I was either going to punch my therapist in the face or walk out, because you had to take one of your most tragic incidents, take that story, I don't care how many there was, take that story and talk about it. I mean, and into detail. And so the first, and he said this is, he said it's normal. He said, I understand, because it sets your emotion up high, because one, after you finish talking about it, he goes, how do you feel? I'm like, well, how do you think I feel? And then he wants you to talk about it again, and again, and you're being recorded. So you record it each time so you can listen back at it. And so the first three, four days, it's like I'm just ramped up. But then the more you talk about it, it comes down. So that's another thing to look into. Those things, two things that were recommended to me, I tried out because I respected the men that told me about it, and they do help. They do help at all. I couldn't, you understand, you can't talk about the things that you've done or seen to people who have never been over there,
100%.
because they don't have a clue, and they can look at TV all they want, but till they're over there, they don't have a clue of what it's like, and they can, sit back and quarterback what they would do and all of that bull crap until you're there, until you're in it, till you've lost somebody, and you don't have a clue. So don't even come with me with your mess if you don't know. So I would talk to guys who've been there, guys I respected, and who's helped me out and still continue to help me out. We had a couple of guys on the team who were, in soft community, and I would talk to them because they would know. They knew and been through it. And some, am I totally 100% over it? No, I don't think once you have that stuff over the years, it's not just gonna break free,
Yeah, vanish. It just
Yeah,
doesn't leave you.
yeah.
It's
Right.
easier. It just doesn't leave you. Certain things will remind you real quick.
Yeah, exactly. So I was getting better with as far as PTS was concerned, and it was and then I got injured over there as well, and so in all since last December I've had 18 surgeries,
Phew.
17 on my neck and back. And the last one was on my rotator cuff, and I'm 59, so it doesn't get any easier getting up in the morning. And but so it's yeah, so it's and then being in pain every day, that's another hard thing. And of course, guys really have to be careful not to get addicted to pain medicine. It's not healthy for you. But I almost got crushed. I got compressed so bad that my neck almost popped through my throat.
Oh my God.
And so most of my neck is titanium. And then they had to put a neural stimulator implant in me. It's about the size of a cell phone. Then a wire that runs up the back of my neck. And taking pain meds, that almost killed me in itself, because I was sitting in my computer chair next to my bed, and I dozed off and landed on the floor with my neck bent. And it wasn't long after I had surgery on my neck with the implant, and it ripped the things from my spine. And I laid on the floor paralyzed for about an hour. You're talking about something scary.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't call for help. My wife was, she was at work, and my son, I couldn't yell for him. He was upstairs, the youngest one, and I only had my two little miniature Dachshunds, my babies, who just looked at me with a sad face and came over. They knew something was wrong, and so one laid on my back with the head beside me, and the other one laid up under my arm. And then finally, I think it just shocked the spinal cord. And after about an hour, I was able to get myself moving. So that was scary in itself. So I was on that path that, but the EMDR and the Prolong, and my wife still says that I should talk if you had a group of guys who vets who've been over there, and just get with someone to talk to. This is not something that you can do on your own.
No, not at all.
And I'll tell you, there was two times I put my foot, well, it was for another reason, and we'll get into it, that I put my 45 in my mouth. I just hit that wall. People say, well, that's selfish. Well, if you've never been that low, you don't know, And I never thought I can hit that low. Until I lost my youngest son. And if you want to talk, we'll talk about that whenever.
Yeah, well, it's perfect time to jump right into it. It's a hard one to touch because no one in my family's ever that I know of committed suicide. I've had a bunch of buddies that coming back from Iraq, they ended their life, and I never could grasp why we made it through all that hell to, you know, take your own life when you get back. And to this day, I can't wrap my finger around it. And that's kind of why I started this podcast, to bring awareness to it. And it's shown some light. Some people have reached out to me, which has been amazing. And thank God, you know. But if you want to go into your son's story, I'll put up some pictures while you talk about his career and what happened that tragic day.
Okay. But before we get into that, I will say, for God, you know, people who don't know this, you know, we hear about veterans, the suicide rate of veterans, which is tragic in itself. But a lot of people don't know that in law enforcement, you have, and I was just, you know, verifying the stats on it, that law enforcement officers are killing themselves 2 times the rate that bad guys are killing them. And so you have in 2021, 600 out of 632 law enforcement deaths, 25% of that, which is about 158, were self-inflicted. And so law enforcement officers, the suicide rate is very high. Every year, you know, I'm on the app that notifies me every time a law enforcement officer gets killed, which is ODMP. The law enforcement is killed in the line of duty. Right now, they're at 53 all across the state. And by the end of the year, usually the averages is usually between 140, 170. But then the suicide rate is even higher for that. As a matter of fact, not too long ago here in Fayetteville, we had an officer kill himself and killed his wife. Well, killed his wife first and then killed himself. And they found that out when he didn't report to work. They went to this house and they found that. And, you know, and what I was told was he dealt a lot because he was a first sergeant there at Bragg. And so he was a vet and he was still dealing with some PTSD issues, I guess. And but he took his life here recently within the last few months. So the rate is really high. It's really hard. And I try to talk to now every time I go down to work out at the training center. They run, Fable runs their own academy class. And, you know, I'll ask to talk to the kids going through the academy. I'll give them the old spiel about, you know, I know you're doing the books, but street life, the streets are going to be different. You know, people are not going to do what you tell them to do. You know, you're going to get into fights. You know, you may get shot at, you know, you may get run over. You know, I've been hit twice, so it's or dragged once and then hit, but so those things will happen. And then I tell them about the potential of PTSD and not to be afraid to talk to someone. You know, it's been a stigma that if you say something, of course, you can understand guys if they say something while they're active or while they're, you know, in SWAT or something like that. One, the team is going to look at them different. Or seem they may lose their job, you know, or they think they're no longer capable. So you can understand why guys won't say nothing then. And, you know, the whole thing of, you know, you're just weak. Well, you know, like you said, PTSD, trauma or stress affects people differently, you know, and different people have gone through different things that, you know, you may not have experienced, but it's when they get out and it's when law enforcement officers retire that if you're dealing with something you can't do it by yourself, you know. Again, for the longest time, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I don't feel it. I didn't think I needed to talk to anybody. Why do I want to talk to anybody? I don't want to hear nobody, you know, with psycho babble and everything. So, but in the end, it helped me, you know. So, and so it helped me. So I was going downhill with PTS, you know, from law enforcement and then from being overseas. Because I worked with a couple of companies where, you know, I was in different countries, and so saw quite a bit, and got the help, and then the incident that happened with my son. My son, he was the youngest. His name is Jonathan. He was the youngest of three. My oldest right now, he's well, that's yeah, that's him, right? Yep. And he my oldest is 35, just had his first child. Him and his wife live in Houston, and then my daughter and her family lives over in Charlotte. She's 32. And then but at the time, my youngest son, he basically went to school and high school down in Tampa, Florida. And he grew up, people would say he was my mini me because he looked like me more than any of the other than the other kids. You know, actually that picture. I'm sorry.
No, you're all right, man. Take your time, brother.
I swore I wasn't gonna do that.
You're fine, man. You're fine. Take your time. You all right?
That picture was a 2 days after, a day or two before he took his life. He was wearing that same shirt. He took a trip up to Fayetteville with his mother to help her drive, and but he went to high school in Tampa. And he wrestled, and his big thing was paintball. He did competition paintball, and he, yeah, he, the second one from the left, and his buddy Andrew's the first one. I mean, to the right, second one from the right. That's Jonathan, and his best friend from Fayetteville was Andrew, and so they played competition. 1 year they came in second in the World Cup there in Orlando,
Wow.
and so he loved paintball, and so that was his thing, and so me and him had a close relationship, real tight. We were because we were always do you know. I had a background in jujitsu and Krav Maga, so he'd always want to roll with dad. And of course, my wife didn't want, she didn't like seeing that. So we did it when she wasn't home. But, and so we were, he wanted to be my mini me. And I've had him talk to a couple of vets in the soft community who are friends of mine's. Because that's what he wanted to get into, eventually become. And his goal was to become a ranger, so we were real tight, and so he went in to be a combat medic, and he came home on leave. And he took a trip up to Fayetteville with his mother, That's his brother and sister. Took a trip up to Fayetteville with his mother for the weekend. Quick, well, they were going to do a turnaround. They were taking a friend back and stay the weekend, but all the other family were gone, so they just turned around and came back. And then in December of 2015, 2015, December 18th, they came back home. And so when they got home, I couldn't travel because one, I think I had one of my back surgeries. And so they came in. It was around 8:30 at night, and I was watching the collegiate playoffs games. And so he helped his mother bring the luggage in, and the kid, he just had a gentle heart. I mean, he was one of those kids that he didn't like bullies at school, and he would stick up for the one being bullied against. He didn't care how big you were. He just did not like, and he'll stand up to you. I mean, I've gotten calls to go to the school, for teachers because, teachers would be treating somebody wrong, and he would stand up for them. And but he had that kind of heart that he would do anything for anyone. So, I've taught him how to be safe with a weapon, all the ins and outs, and what not to do at home, and not to touch the firearm if I'm not home, and making sure it's dry. Dry meaning no ammo. And so I would take him through all of the fundamental, steps and everything. So he learned about the handguns, but then he really got interested in guns. And so this kid, when he gets locked into on something, he would, I mean, he knew more about firearms than I did. And I mean, he would just read and read and research on all kinds of weapons. And so, but he wanted to eventually be a ranger. And so when they came home, he oh, t 2 weeks prior, he wanted to no, I told him, I gave him a I think it was a Smith and Wesson 40 caliber. And so I said, you can't take it upstairs. Will you give it to me? So I went to put it and lock it away. And so, and at some point, I don't know when, but he found it, and how he got it open. The kid was just, I don't know if he had got one of my books. I went to lock picking school or something. And he took it up because he wanted to practice more, which I thought. And I didn't know he had it in him. I thought it was locked away. And the one thing he did know about me, he knew with my background that I knew how to read body language real good. And so I guess he gauged all that and knew how to hide things. And one thing I would caution parents, never say, my kid won't do this, because you don't know what they're going through, especially in the service. But if you just see one change that doesn't seem right, you need to talk to him about it. And what he would do, he would stay in his room longer with his door closed. And maybe I should have monitored that more. But he was in the military, came home for leave. Hey, let him do that. But so he knew to hide things real well. And then actually, so before that, I was of course, I'm a believer of Jesus Christ. I'm not ashamed of my faith, and I'll tell people quick, because guys will say, "Oh, Daryl's religious." I was like, "Daryl's not religious at all. I'm far from being religious. I am not a religious person, but I do have a relationship with Christ Jesus." And that's a big difference, you know. And I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so all of my kids, you know, believed in the Lord. But and Jonathan, actually, he there was a church that I was leading, a church security team, and we'd have a lot of high profile pastors and speakers come in. And this day, it was I was doing personal protection for John Bevere, and he came in, and I thought Jonathan was. He said he was going to paintball practice, so I wasn't even expecting. You know, the membership there was about 3,000, so I wasn't even expecting him to, you know, to be there. And so during the message of John Bevere, you know, he had called all the young people up, or did an altar call, and all these young people came up, and so he's standing, and I'm standing to the left of the stage of him, waiting for him when he would come down, and so he's talking to all these kids, and he points out to this one kid, and he just speaks into his life, and I'm like, okay, that's cool, you know, someone's getting born again, and he told him how, you know, that God's gonna, you know, God has something for you. I'm like, okay. And then just before he came off the stage, I looked, and that person he was talking to was Jonathan, who I didn't even know was there.
Wow.
And I'm
It's
like,
amazing.
and so I told John when he came, I said, you know, you were talking to my son. I didn't even know he's supposed to be here. He's like, what? And so it was pretty amazing that he really committed his life to the Lord then.
Yeah,
And
for sure.
but then a week later, you know, take the trip, comes back home, helps his mother with the luggage, gives me a big old bear hug, and goes upstairs, and then. And then he comes outside, goes outside. I'm sitting there, we're sitting in the living room watching the TV, the football game. And he goes outside, and it was pretty chilly, and, you know, for Tampa. He had a short sleeve shirt on. And I said, hey, well, after about 20 minutes, my wife's like, why don't you tell Jonathan to come inside? So at first I was like, why don't you go get him? Because I'm watching the game. But I'm glad I did. So I went out there. I didn't see him at first. I thought maybe he was just taking a walk around the block, and then I said, "Well, let me get my flashlight, my keys, and tell him to, you know, it's a little chilly out here for a short sleeve shirt. Come on inside." So I go out there a second time and went to the left. We had lived on the corner lot and the driveway, you know. One end came out one street, the other end came out the other street. So I went to the left, was looking for him, and it wasn't until I went to the right is when I hit him with my flashlight, I saw him laying on the ground, and he was laying on the side with his back towards me, you know, just perfect. And I was like, okay, I knew he was dealing with something, because between basic and AIT. Well, after basic, I mean, basically, he was like, that was fun. It was not too AIT. Something happened there. To this day, we don't know what, but he had a psychological breakdown, and so I thought he was having a moment. I said, Jonathan, get off the ground. It was dew on the ground. I was like, it's cold. He didn't move, so I walked closer, and while I'm walking closer, I was like, nah, what I'm thinking, he wouldn't do that. So when I get there and I hit his face with a shot flashlight, you know, I've seen plenty of dead bodies, you know, there was no brain matter splattered or anything. He had short hair just like you saw, and but I saw his eyes, and I've seen that look before. And I'm like, what? And then I saw a drop of blood, and then What scared me was, or scared me and made me mad at the same time, was I couldn't find a gun, and I thought someone had just shot my kid, and so I was going hunting, and so I told my, I just went into what I call work mode. I just calmly walked inside. I told my wife, said, "Hey, call 911," and she just screamed, "What?" I said, "No, well, let me do that." Got my headset on. I called Tampa police and told them, what I have, and went back there outside with him. And I finally found the gun. It was, I don't know how I got there, but it was between his feet. And he had big feet. And so I finally saw it. So I said, "Okay." And so I checked, pulse and everything. Of course, he has expired then. And so I stayed with him. I got a only thing I find in the back of my car was a coat. Put a c coat over him, and I just sat on the ground till the police got there. So Tampa police, we lived in a gated community, so they rolled in there four deep from downtown. And I had the first officer kind of yelled at me, and I yelled back because I was. When he pulled up, I was showing him my badge, just my ID credentials, and he's like, "Get your hands out of your pocket." I said, "Oh, I yelled out. I said, "I'm just trying to show you my ID, you idiot." And so I didn't care then, but and so he came over, so they talked to me and they talked to my wife. And of course, I knew what they were doing. They see if the stories fit, because I had like three or four officers ask me the same questions in different ways to see if my story changed. And so I was cool. I don't know if they were thinking something that was just too calm. It's just the mode that I went in, just to make sure he was taken care of, and waited for the medical examiner. And a good thing for the sergeant for Tampa PD that he asked me to wait inside while the medical examiner, examined him, and I guess it moved him around, and I don't know if that was set me off or anything. So he asked me to stay inside, which I complied. And then after they put him, they took him, he took the hose from the side of my house to wash down the blood, which I appreciated. And so they did a phenomenal job as far as the scene out there. And but after they left and I closed that door and sat down, that's when I broke. My neighbor, he had I first actually when I went outside after I saw John, I told my wife to call 911. I called him. Then I went across the street to my neighbor, who was he was a retired Marine, and but he wasn't home. But I guess his son called him, and so he came from where he came, and but he came inside. I told him, police it was okay for him to come inside, and but after they left, I broke, and I couldn't even talk on the phone. Well, to a good friend of ours, I couldn't talk to them. But then with the other hardest thing was, Alan, was I had to tell my son, my daughter, and my mother, who lived in Fayetteville. Actually, they're all in Fayetteville at the time, and that was those were the my two of the three were the real hardest call. My oldest son, I mean, him and his wife, they were troops. I mean, they were like, "Okay, we're on our way." And they were down there to help us in no time. I mean, and they just kind of took over, and I really appreciated and loved them for that. But my daughter was traveling with her husband's family, which I don't call them brother and sister-in-law. I call them brothers and sister because we're real close. And they were traveling from Atlanta back to Fayetteville, and so I called her while they were traveling, and they had to pull over the side of the road to console her. And then I had to have a friend of my, couple friend of mine's to go over to my mother's house because she was in her high 80s then, and she was living alone because my father passed away years ago. And so it was about 5 o'clock in the morning because she it was on by that time it was Sunday morning. I know we knew she goes to church early, so that's right. I had my son-in-law and another friend go over there when I called because I wanted somebody to be there when I called my mother. So those were hard calls to make, and so yeah, it's nothing like losing a child. If they really committed about taking their lives, you can they're gonna find a way. And in my case, he never wrote anything down or never said anything, because actually he promised his mother, he said, "Mom, I would never do that." A few years prior, he said, "I would never take my life." Well, so you just don't know. But there were a couple of changes that, I wish I really would have picked up on faster that I noticed with him. So that's what I caution with parents, to watch for those signs. And then the neighbors, I was the only, the Tampa police said that I was the only call that came in. I'm like, and what it was, my son knew exactly what to do. What he did was he just pressed the barrel to his temple. So that's why no one heard anything. And my dogs were sensitive to those noise. They didn't even move. So that's what so he knew what he was doing. So but yeah, it was a rocky it's been a rocky roll. Time helps, but it's every Christmas is hard around that time and in the new year. So but here's the thing. I was like, okay, God, you're something else. So my daughter, she's pregnant with her fourth child, and it happens to be that her due date is the same date that my son passed away.
Oh my goodness.
I'm like,
Wow.
wow. And so don't know what that means, but I was like, wow.
It means something for sure in a positive way.
So as far as home support, as well, as far as a relationship in the household was that we supported each other, and it was good that both of us didn't break down at the same time.
For sure.
So one was a pillar for the other, and so that's, we were kind of blessed to have that. The one thing what can easily happen is the husband and wife can start blaming each other. And this is where you start having separations over a lost child. And I caution people about that. Help each other out. Don't do the blame game because it's, that's not helping. You're both stressed. You both lost your child. And that's when you have to come together even more and have that family support even more. So yeah, I miss the old kid, and
Sure you do.
people ask me, say, well, aren't you mad with God? I'm like, no. I said, God knows what he's doing. Because I look, God is God, and everybody has a stamp, a date on their lives. We were just blessed to have a gift for 21 years, So he's gone. Yeah, it hurts, miss him, but I'm not going to blame God for that. Who am I? So I'm just grateful for the friends and family support because it was well needed,
For sure. Well, I got one question for you.
Sure.
If your son was sitting here right now listening to you, mm-hmm. what's one thing that you would say to him?
Well, I would say, that's a good question.
It could be anything.
My wife and I, we made a joke about it. We were like, what's the one thing we would do when we see Jonathan again? I said, I'm going to punch that boy in his mouth. I was like, you're for doing what he did. Just leaving us like that. I was like, Joker, you know what you put us through? Mm. You know? And he would laugh. He has this big old this voice that carries. But I would just say, you know, just stay on track, stay focused, have a purpose. But even now, it's not so much what I would say to him, it's what he said to me after his death. And this may sound spooky to people, whatever, it happened. I was in my mother's house, and a week after he passed, whether it was a vision or whatever, I was laying on one couch, and I didn't see his face, but I heard his voice. He says, Dad, he says, in his deep voice, he said that, trying to get choke up again.
Take your time, man.
He said that, stay on point. And I knew what he meant, you know, had stay on point with your passion and your purpose. And so it was more of what he said to me, but for him is, you know, hey, I will see you soon. You know, whenever, whether Jesus returns or what happens, you know, we will see each other again, and look forward to it. And I love you, you know, and that's the one thing that I am so grateful for all of my kids, even in their older age now. They are not ashamed to say, Dad, I love you, you know, and they would say it in front of their friends or give me a hug in front of their friends. And you know when you find a young man like even in that generation, you know, they may be ashamed to do that in front of their friends, and you know, and ashamed to be talked about, but not him. They would give me a hug and say, you know, love you, Dad. And and so I am really grateful for that. And but yep. Yeah. Love you, bud.
Mm-hmm. Man, that touched me, bro. I'm not lying. I can only imagine how y'all feel.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine, you know. But like you said, time, it'll never go away. I mean,
right.
But time makes it a little easier, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And I appreciate you sharing your story and your son's story, because that people who watch this is going to touch them. I'm telling you. And hopefully it touches somebody to where they don't ever want to do that.
Right. Right.
You know, and man, it's, mm-hmm. Ooh. They got me.
Yeah, especially if you have children, I tell you, it's, yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, that's the hardest thing. Of course, it seemed like we in our household we had it pretty easy, but that one hit dead in the gut, and there's nothing like it. I can't describe anything else that can, you know, other than probably losing your spouse, but losing your child.
Yeah.
Nothing like it, you know. And don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to tell you, you know, one of the things I had to learn early on with my first son is to be a good listener. And not so much of a dictator, because that's what my father was to me. He was more of a dictator. I had to learn to be a listener, and take interest in what my son and daughter were interested in, the youngest one, he was interested in paintball. That's, I mean, that, and I made sure I was there for, to support him in his practices, to his competitions. And that they appreciated that, they look for that. They want to know that they're loved. Not so much that, they'll say they love me, but I need them to know that I love them no matter what. And I told them, I said, I don't care what you've done. Don't be afraid to tell me. Consequences? Oh yeah, there may be consequences. And I would throw my youngest one off kilter, because after the consequence, I forget about it. I said, it's done. I'm not going to hold on to it, or rehash it. Hey, you did this. Here's the consequence. Let's move on. Enough said. And so when I realized that that was, I was listening instead of telling, and being interested in what they were interested in, that's when we bonded closer, for all three. And so I'm still glad with the other two. We have still a great relationship because of that. But I had to learn that the hard way with my son when he was 18. I was more of the dictator, and we were separating apart. And I don't even know how it came up, but or how it happened. But I learned to, be quick to listen, slow to speak. And so I've learned to listen and take interest. So once we hit that 21 age, we went out for a beer, and so he probably, even to the last week, he was like, he sent me a video, my oldest one, about playing golf. He was showing me, he was on the range. I was like, yeah, hey, I don't know how much I can do it with my back, but come down to Houston, I said, we'll do 9 rounds or something. And so he appreciates that,
Absolutely.
so be a good listener.
Absolutely. And I'm gonna apply it to my life too, because I'm kind of the same way, man. I like a dictatorship, you know what I mean? But I don't, I think it's the background we have, you know what I mean? It's got to be. So that's something I can learn from and apply it. So I'm gonna work on that myself. So I learned something myself today too. So, well, brother, I appreciate you coming on. Your story's amazing, and I'm gonna get it out as soon as possible. I just want this one to really resonate with the listeners and get something out of it, because this is one that hit home for you really hard. So I know it's hard to share it. I know we talked a few, wrote down, I was gonna give you time to recover, and but thank you for sharing that
Appreciate
story. I know we've been trying to get it for a little while. I had some stuff I was dealing with, and we pushed through it. And
That's it.
today's the 4th of July, so happy 4th of July, brother.
Same to you, bro.
And
Appreciate you.
hang around for a second. I'm
Okay.
gonna ask you something once we leave this little deal. Well, just don't leave. I'll end the recording.
Right.
So,
Right.
well,
Okay.
all right. Thank you again for coming on. I know the listeners are going to love it, and sharing that amazing story.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it.